Hey everybody, this week's iTunes episode is on Val Kilmer. Again, this is 2 weeks late. This episode already came out a couple weeks ago. But if you are super into Val Kilmer, and who isn't into Val Kilmer? Val Kilmer's awesome. Make sure to check out the Patreon at subbeacon.com. We have a members only exclusive forever Val Kilmer movie draft. Very exciting. Lots of great things. You can vote on the winner. I don't know if that poll is still open. I think it's actually closed now. But if it is still open, you can vote on it. And if you were a member, you would not have missed it if it is closed now. I don't really know how the polls work at Patreon, but we'll figure that out. Anyway, you should sign up at the Patreon. It's as little as $1 a month. You know, as much as a million billion dollars a month. You know, I don't know what a million billions is. It's a lot, probably. It's Elon Musk money. So go sign up, listen to the exclusive Patreon only episodes forever, like the Val Kilmer draft and other stuff. And, I hope you enjoy this episode.
My name is Val Kilmer. I'm an actor. I've lived a magical life and I've captured quite a bit of it.
Push the button.
I was the first guy I knew to own a video camera.
Here we are. Filming ourselves.
Is that a
it's
video
rolling,
camera?
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool, Val.
I have thousands of hours of videotapes and film reels that I've shot throughout my life and career.
Shut the video camera off.
I will keep it on until we're rehearsing.
Oh, damn.
I was recently diagnosed with throat cancer. I'm still recovering, and it is difficult to talk and to be understood. But I want to tell my story more than ever.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Subbeacon. I'm Victor Mattis, along with Jonathan V. Last and Sonny Bunch. Just a reminder, the Subbeacon is now available through Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com. You'll easily find us. Please subscribe, tell your friends. And don't forget about the Subbeacon merchandise store at tpublic.com. Gentlemen, how are we? JVL, what's going on?
Victorino, you've been holding out on us.
About what?
That your storefront?
Let's save that for the outtake.
Vic's place.
Yeah, Vic's place. It's Vic's oven. It's Vic's oven.
Vic's oven.
Oh,
a lot of tentacles on that storefront.
Oh, come on, we can discuss that later.
We'll get to that.
We'll save that.
Okay, that's a hell of a tease for people.
It's one of the best I'm sure it's finds ever. What is going on with you? Anything? Talk to me.
I'm down at the beach, nice. And I took Flash out to surf on the big board.
Yeah.
He's outgrown his tween board, and he's ready for a man sized log. And so, put him phrasing. Is that a problem?
Sonny and I had the same expression. The tilted head.
I would say that if you were describing something as a man-sized log, it belongs in a toilet.
Mm. Okay, well, that's better than the other. Anyway, Flash wanted to try the longboard, and so I took him out of the longboard, and now at age 13, in addition to being faster than me, throwing a baseball harder than me, and hitting a baseball farther than me, he surfs better than me, too. And that was cool. That was cool. But I pulled up because you know how Apple Photos shoots the thing like, hey, on this date, X number of years ago, this. So I got one of those. And it was actually the day I got my longboard 12 years ago.
Oh,
and
I remember that.
So I had it on the floor of the place we had down here, and next to me was Flash, who had his own little board, which was a tummy time mat, because he was 5 months old and had like a tummy time surfboard mat. And the passage of time between watching him like go shredding on this thing that I barely even take off the wall anymore because I just don't have the time to do it effortlessly. But then looking at this thing where yesterday I remember him on the tummy time mat.
Whereas the difference of being like 48 and 36 is like, you know.
Yeah.
It's yeah. not much. In yeah. some ways, I'm better. Anyway.
Yeah. yeah. But the other thing that's funny to watch is there was a couple of young ladies down here, roughly age appropriate. Not really. They're like 3 years too old for him. But for Flash, okay. not for you,
I think
Victorino.
You're talking about me. Sorry. Go ahead.
And it is funny to watch the Pavlovian response of the 13-year-old male to, you know, 15 and 16-year-old girls in swimsuits. Unlike the Pavlovian response of 48-year-old males. This is a sight gag, so people listening will not be able to see this. But, mm-hmm. you know, like, they walk by while you're mid-conversation with him, and he just... like without even realizing tracks. What he's doing,
just his eyes track just the scene.
The eyes track, and just you know, without even then, he's like, "Whoa, wait, where am I? What? Yeah, you know, like Will Ferrell in Old School when he comes out of the debate.
Whereas for us, it's like you willfully not look at them. You can't look at them. That's the thing. You know, when you see them, you go, and it's like it's obvious that you're not looking at them, and you know. And then you realize you were staring at them the entire time. But, you know, it's you know the line in Roxanne?
Keep going. You know keep the line going.
You remember the
lesson
line
about this is just stay away from beaches?
Legally I'm not allowed to be on the beach. there's a line in Roxanne where the guy's warning Rick Rossovich. Speaking of Rick Rossovich. But they're warning him. About not looking at the nose, because every time you're thinking about not looking at the nose, you realize the entire time you've been looking at the nose. So
yeah.
Anyway.
So. Yeah. It's funny. It's funny to watch. Yeah. But I'm glad you're not here because your ankle bracelet will be going off.
I just want to get the newspaper. It goes off. They threw it in the front. I had to get it. Sonny.
How are you, Victorino?
I'm doing fine. But we'll get to me. I'm doing fine. Sonny, you're saying that I look like I didn't have much sleep. And it's true. I'm tired. I'm dragging. We had, you know, it's been nonstop rain. This is even before Hurricane Fred made its way, sort of the remnants up here. So this was just a lot of rain. And I think on Sunday, they said it was like 4 inches in the span of a couple hours in the middle of the night. And then on top of that, we got another big dump of rain two nights ago. And sure enough, the garage was just flooding with water, and it was coming in from the outside. So if you could see, you can't see, but in our driveway, even with the garage door down, it's about, you know, ankle deep in water that fills up. I mean, it was just pouring in. So then we get the wet vac out and the mop, and then we just had to go to town. And then at some point, Kate just gave. She couldn't do it anymore. She's like, I can't do this. But luckily, my son was awake, and he stayed with me till 2 a.m., doing the whole thing, and we just opened the door into the garage and just vacuumed as much water as we can out, and then it fills up so fast, and then you got to dump it out. I mean, it's just so much water. So yeah. That's my situation.
I don't understand.
We don't have need a sump pump.
We totally need a sump pump or a French drain, but then it's like the estimates. It's like getting an appointment. Okay, when can we meet them? They'll get to you at a certain time. Everybody's schedules, work schedules, are so out of whack these days that it's...
I don't understand the actual physics of where the water is coming from. Is it like pulling up in front of your? It's pulling up in front of your garage door and coming in that way.
Yeah, so the water comes from underneath the garage door from outside, mm-hmm. in the rain, and then it makes its way down the garage, the small garage that it is, and then it starts to pool near where the door is to the basement, and then it starts to come through underneath the door. Though it's a pretty well-sealed door, but it's coming through the cracks. It's coming from under the ground. It was coming through under, like, the you know, I mean, it's just, there's nowhere for the, as they say, you get to the point where it's completely saturated. There's nowhere for the water to go.
So. You need sandbags outside your garage door.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then the inside, and then on the outside of the door, that's the only thing you do.
Is it a function of, like, your driveway not being the right grade? Is it, like, tilted back towards your house?
Yes, it's not as bad as some houses, but, I mean, I this has only been a problem in the last, I don't know, year or so. So, I don't know. Like I said,
is this because you guys did that remodeling?
No. I can't even remember the remodeling that we did.
Didn't you do something in the basement?
Oh, a bathroom on the other side. That's on the other side of the basement. So that side of the basement, the finished part where I am recording right now, has been knock on wood, dry. And it used to get wet, but no longer now. It's very strange. We don't know what's happening. But that's my situation. But hopefully won't get too much rain. You know, it's just August in D.C. It's not too bad. Sonny, what's going on with you?
I don't have a ton going on. I suffered a weird injury yesterday. I don't know what exactly happened to me. Like, I was holding my almost three-year-old, and he, like, made a weird move, and I made kind of a weird move. And all of a sudden, my back was like, no, don't do that. And I was like, well, this is a weird old man injury.
That is a total old man injury.
I'm not 100% sure what has just happened. Because I'm used to, like, you tweak your lower back, right? Like, yeah. I'm used to that. Like, you know, you like, wrench That's it the wrong way common. Or something. Or, like, or the kids jump on your lower back or whatever. And you're like, okay, yeah, I get why that. But this was my upper back. Like where my, like...
Shoulder blades?
Yeah, like, where my shoulders meet my ribs. I don't know how to describe it exactly, except for the fact that I, like, can't move more than about this without feeling, you know, weird tension in my back. I to the point where I, like, literally just stood in the shower for, like, 10 minutes.
Hard to breathe,
with
the
water
too, on. if you twist.
No, it's not breathing. That's fine. It's not a rib cage injury. I've had those before, and that this is not like that. It's like... It's weird. I don't know. It's like,
I think,
the muscles.
You know, I think Jonathan, I will tell you, the only thing you have to do now is go to a chiropractor.
Absolutely not.
Once a week
not.
For the rest of your life.
I don't need my back punched. Okay. So that's, like, literally the only thing that's happening in my world right now is trying to figure out, like, what have I done to my back and how serious is it? I don't think it's, I think it's already feeling a little bit better.
Yeah.
But it is just a reminder that getting older and, you know, body falling apart. I also get those, like, memory things on my phone, JBL.
Yeah.
And it definitely is like, oh, yeah, I remember when my 5 years ago when, you know, children were small and helpless. Now they're running around destroying my back.
The weird thing is, I'll get some of those, and it'll be before I got my Wolverine blood, and I was like, wow, I look terrible back then.
But now you look great.
Now, I mean, unstoppable, monoclonal antibodies. Everyone should get them. I wanted to ask you guys this, because this recently happened here, which is, of course, in Arlington County, which is so much tax money, they don't know what to do with it. Every residence got the other week a little kit. It looks like a little cooler, and in fact it is a compost kit. They want you to start composting. You know, composting. Do you guys compost? Do you have to compost? Do you compost?
I'd rather light my dick on fire.
I'm sorry, what was that, Sonny? You'd rather what?
I'd rather light my dick on fire than start composting.
I'm not
gonna play around in trash and rotting garbage.
Because that's the thing, you know, that's because you start doing starts with recycling and then you start sorting out the recycling, and then after that the last step is composting.
Not in Texas, my friend.
I was gonna say, you don't do composting in Texas?
I'm sure there are people who compost in Dallas. I'm sure that I bet it's a big Austin thing. I bet people in Austin
they do. Willfully,
but in Dallas, no, that's not a thing.
In the first time I discovered this was when I studied abroad when I was in Vienna, and there was, like, all these different bins, and if it's your floor's turn to do y'all have to take turns taking care of the kitchen, and then it'll be like my turn and my roommate, and then, you know, you sort out the garbage and recycling, and then there was a green bin, and if you had the unfortunate situation to lift that lid, like, what is this? And then you lift it, and then you see what it is, which is everybody's leftover foods, you know, accumulating, piled high for a week.
Just put it in the trash like a civilized culture.
It's so gross. The other thing is, well, I'll tell you what's also crazy, right? Because if you want to compost, just, you know, I say go all out. And yet I saw the list. They give you a list in the little kit. It tells you that there's a guy.
Yeah, explain to us what's in this actual kit. Explain
okay,
to us
well,
what
it's
the
an
actual
empty, it looks like
is.
An empty cooler, and it comes with a biodegradable, liner that you put inside, and all you do is you dump your leftover, you know, perishables in there, and then you wrap it up, and then you put it in your green compost. Well, it's not a compost bin. What you put all your, leaves and all the other yard waste, yard trimmings.
Waste.
Yes, yes. You could put it in there, and that's how it works. Out of curiosity, I've started to do it, but just with coffee grounds and eggshells, and we'll see what happens. But I looked at the list of things that they won't let you put in the compost. Number one, human waste. Well, I was a little too late for that because
you're not allowed to poop in the bucket.
Apparently not. I thought that's compost. And the second thing is medical waste. I have all these needles.
Night soil.
And then medical, I have all these needles from over the years of all my, injections. And they're all sitting.
Oh,
they're, yes.
Hold on.
And they're all in these, how do I get rid of those Sharps containers? Right. I thought I was just putting in the compost.
All right, Danny Boyle.
Thank you.
What are you doing
thank
with
you.
All those?
I'll
what
tell you
doing
the one thing.
The one thing
I do. A kid in our neighborhood started a glass recycling, and I really admired his sales pitch. It was written probably with the help of a parent, but nevertheless written very, very directly, which is what it is, what we do, and how we undercut the competition by offering it for cheaper. I said I admire that.
Wait. Son. I don't understand. He's offering.
Pick up glass
recycling.
What
is he doing?
He picks up like $5 a week, and he'll pick up your glass recycling and take it to the recycling. Because, of course, our Lincoln County can't do recycling anymore for glass.
Why not?
Just, they can't do it. But, hey, make sure you recycle. There's something else that they're not going to be able to do soon, like plastic or paper. And they're like, hey, make sure everybody recycles. What are we putting in there?
Wait. So I don't understand. So are you – all right. Now I'm actually curious because this is really interesting. So in your ridiculous city where you live.
Yeah, it is ridiculous.
You are required to recycle. Is that right?
Oh, they want you to recycle.
It's the law
that
you have to recycle. If you put recycling in the garbage, you could, in theory, get in trouble with Johnny Law.
I've always wondered about that because, every now and then you do and you're like, what are they going to do, report you? I have no idea. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. So second question. They have stopped taking glass?
Yes.
Why
they want
they
you to.
Glass?
They want you to recycle the glass, but they're not going to bring it to the facility anymore. You have to do it
yourself.
Why not? I don't know.
Why won't they do it?
Because
don't you pay taxes so they will pick up your trash for you?
And this was in the news. This is one of the worst things I ever saw in the news where they were explaining about not being able to do the recycling thing anymore, but you could still use glass. And a guy was literally saying, you could put flowers in your bottles. Anyway.
All right, so they want you to recycle things. They want you to recycle the glass, but they won't pick it up.
Yeah.
And they expect you to take it to the recycling.
Yeah, and it's really kind of a gross facility. I run past it on Lee Highway. Because everybody just puts it.
Do you get like return money for these bottles or whatever?
No,
do
they, I don't.
You, you
no,
show up and
no,
you don't
no.
get like 5
Here,
cents a
no,
bottle or whatever?
No. You're just supposed
so
to do it.
You're just supposed to take it there
because
that's your civic responsibility?
Yes, Sonny, because it's your
fuck
I look where I'm pointing.
That. I would throw every single piece of glass in the garbage.
Yeah, we do.
And I would not think twice about it.
Well, I
and
tell you
I like
that's
I,
how
I've,
I generally
like, often,
feel.
Look, yeah. I've often I do the recycling, even though it's foolishness. That's like
total waste.
It doesn't actually save the environment at all. We should just put all of this crap in landfills or whatever. There are a lot of landfills. We got plenty of space. But if the city of Dallas came to me and was like,
"You just should do it.
We would really like you to keep recycling, but we're not going to pick up your glass or your plastic."
Mm-hmm. You can
or I'd be like,
yourself.
Thank you very much for your suggestion.
And now,
but all of this crap is going directly in the trash. It's going directly in the trash, and I could not possibly be bothered to like put it in my car and take it. I'm not going to put my disgusting, filthy glass with the leaking remnants of whatever you were drinking gathering at the bottom of the bag, and you get a hole in it. And it's
garbage juice,
filth, garbage juice all over your car.
Garbage
you have to be kidding me. I would.
Thank you. Sir.
Question.
JVL. Yes, JVL.
Did you hire the kid?
Yeah, I admired his entrepreneurial spirit.
Question. How old is the kid, and how many houses in the neighborhood do you think have signed up with this?
I bet you a ton because it's Arlington. He's probably, I don't know, 14, 15, I guess. And he goes around and he picks it up.
$5 a week, you said?
Yeah.
And how is he billing you? Is you pay him cash or does
PayPal.
He have Square?
PayPal.
Oh, PayPal. So you just PayPal him. Yeah. So let's say he's got 10 houses, $50 a week. That's not bad money for...
It is not bad money. Here's the problem, though. He picks up the glass, and then he gets to, obviously, if he picks up for my house, then he sees it's just a lot of liquor bottles, which is kind of, you know, I like, don't judge me, but I'm sure he is. Like, gee, what are these people doing here?
Question.
Yes.
Wait.
Was he also selling Highlights subscriptions?
Yes, he was selling Highlights. How did you know? And I signed up for 5 years worth of a subscription.
Wait. Are you, you're not putting the bottles in a bag and like tying the bag off?
No, I just put it in a shopping bag, a pile. I just throw it in a giant shopping bag piled up. Take the glass.
You want it. You just have like a... In the grass of your yard, you just have chucked a bunch of bottles
just,
out there.
Yeah, and needles.
Like, Timmy, go get the bottles. They're right there, Timmy.
You know, I'm sure he must think at this point, I'm like, I don't know, Jim Morrison or something. Speaking of which, this week we're talking about the documentary Val on Amazon Prime. Rick Brosovich would have been a better transition, but it was too early. Sonny, how about a Big Boy review?
Are we going to know box office thoughts this weekend?
You're saying there's a box office?
Box office.
What's
There's
happened?
Box office
oh,
thoughts.
Right. Something about a big drop. Usually it's about 40% or so, right? How did Suicide Squad do?
Suicide Squad dropped 70%. 70%. That's
is that good? High that score wins, right?
That is a Batman versus Superman size drop. That's a big drop. It's bad. I mean, look, it's bad. I'm hesitant to like make a bunch of grand predictions and projections about what this means because we are still in very weird times. A, the movie is on HBO Max. B, Delta variant raging across the country. Everyone's very nervous about sitting in a movie theater. C, this had a lot of like kind of inherent problems because it's a sequel to a movie that people kind of hated. And D, it kind of counted on Margot Robbie to drive the box office, and that's a terrible idea because she's not a star. So I don't know. There's a lot of different things about this, but that's a huge enormous drop. It's bad. You don't want to see that sort of thing. It's going to end up grossing the Suicide Squad will probably end up grossing less than Suicide Squad did on its first day of release. That's how bad
that
is
astonishing.
That's how bad the release of this movie has been for HBO Max and Warner Brothers and the rest. I mean, who knows? Maybe it led to a million people signing up on HBO Max, and that, you know, RPU is very large, so it could be worth.
Is it still the great deal, what is that the number one movie still at the box office technically?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was. Hold on, I just got to check real quick. No, it was the fifth movie this weekend at the box office. It went all the way from first to fifth. Number one movie at the weekend this weekend was number one movie at the box office this weekend was Free Guy.
Oh, of course,
28.4 million.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then Don't Breathe 2 did 10.6, which is solid but unremarkable. Jungle Cruise holds okay at $9 million. It's down 40%, something like that. But yeah, terrible.
So is the pandemic lesson here that we have to reset all of our expectations for box office declines, especially for properties that are also available on streaming in some form or another, and that if it's a kids movie or a family movie, then you can expect 1% set of percentage declines because there are just still people who need to get their children out of the house.
Yeah,
and going to a movie is a way to do it.
Yeah.
But all other movies are just like we no longer assume that, you know, we're at a 40 to 45% decline week over week. We've got to assume 55 or 60% or something like that.
I would say you have three separate questions here. The first proposition is a movie that is released on theaters and streaming simultaneously is going to drop in the between 65% and 70%. I think that is there is an audience that wants to go to the movies. They go to the movies. It's very front loaded, and then that number, the decrease from week to week is enormous. You see it you see it with basically every HBO Max release. You see it with all of these movies. The Disney Premier Access is slightly different. Those hold a little bit better, but not that much better. But the ones that are family films, as you say, JBL, do tend to have better multiples. Now the multiple is the total box office versus the opening weekend. So I think Cruella had a multiple of 4, which would be good in, which would be very, very good in normal times. It's a little bit harder to judge here because its opening weekend was only 21 million. So a multiple of 4 on that is still not, it's still like kind of modest, but it's better than anything else has been doing. The Jungle Book movie, I think is going to hold very well. Jungle Cruise. Is holding pretty well. It dropped 55% the first weekend, which is not a great drop in like a normal time. That would be like, oh, 55%. Well, that's okay. That's about average. But for what we're seeing now, it's actually pretty good. And then second to third weekend drop was only 42%. So that's going to hold. That's going to play all summer, I think. I think that's going to be a surprise kind of movie that did very well. But even movies that are not immediately on streaming, you're seeing big drops like this, like A Quiet Place 2. Very good reviews, decent cinema score for a horror movie, and huge opening weekend box office, like almost equal to the first movies, and that came out in, you know, non-pandemic time, so different expectations, whatever. But even that movie dropped, I think, 65% or something like that, first weekend to second weekend. Now it held. It after that big first weekend drop, it kind of normalized and did okay through the rest of the summer, even after it was out on VOD. It was out on VOD while it was still in theaters, and people were still going to see it in theaters. But I like it's if you are looking at the box office numbers right now, it used to be that a 50% drop was average for a good blockbuster, like 45% to 50%. If a movie dropped 45% to 50%, you're like, yeah, this is good. If it was 50-55%, you're like, ah, it's not bad. But if it was like 60-65%, you're like, ooh, this is trouble.
That's and then John Carter of Mars territory.
Oof. Yeah, I mean, like, I think I want to say that Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice dropped something like 67 or 68% first weekend to second weekend. And you're seeing that on everything. You're seeing that on everything now.
Yeah.
Which means that, again, there's a core audience of people who want to come to the theaters and see things in theaters. And they all go out the opening weekend. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's a much lower trickle of the audience.
Yeah.
This is my big point here is that as we head towards Dune, all of you Dune fans should not get your hopes up for Dune Part 2.
You've been trolling the Dune fans, Sonny.
Dune Part 1 is about all you're going to get on that one. And I say this sadly, I say this with sadness, because I like Denis Villeneuve, as you guys know. He's one of my favorite directors. Denis Villeneuve, he's the best. And I support Denis Villeneuve when he's out there on the social media talking about, you know, we need the theatrical experience. Yeah. My movie is designed to be seen in a theater. Watching it on TV at home is like, you know, listening or like, what was the line he used? It's like using a speedboat in a bathtub, which is a great visual image. So, you know, I feel bad for him. Coming off of Blade Runner 2049 to be hit with Dune in the middle of a pandemic, but that movie is going to gross $50 million at the box office.
Is Ana de Armas going to be in that movie? Because I would watch that.
She is not in that one, sadly. She's not
such
in
a
that
big
one.
Fan.
Total, you give me an opening weekend number.
I think it could do $50 million opening weekend. I think it will. I would be shocked if it does. If it gets to $100 million domestic, I would be very, very surprised. I think it's probably going to be closer to like 30 million opening, 80 million total.
When is Dune coming out?
Dune comes out October.
Mm-hmm. I'll take the under.
You'll take the under on 30-80?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll take the under on that. And I'll tell you this. We'll get Dune Part 2 the same weekend we get the Remo Williams The Adventure Continues.
Buckaroo Banzai.
I will say, here's
King Solomon's Mines.
There were two of them. They did two King Solomon's Mines.
No, they didn't. What?
They absolutely did. I will effort this, but I'm the Richard Chamberlain, the very manly Richard Chamberlain, with the first appearance of Sharon Stone, and introducing Sharon Stone, and I saw that movie when I was 13.
And you thought
Slash's age, and when I saw her on screen, I just was like, oh, she's gonna be a star.
Yeah, I will say. So here's the only thing I will push back on here is I do think that Dune was always a movie that was going to have trouble at the box office anyway, because it's a movie that is deeply beloved by a smallish number of people. And like that sort of thing is very much like Blade Runner 2049, where you think like, oh, we've got this great property. We have to exploit it. People will go, and like it doesn't end up working out that way. So this may actually be the best thing. This may actually be the reason we get a Dune Part 2, is because somebody at Warner Brothers is like, well, we can't hold it against them that they only grossed, you know, $77 million at the domestic box office. It's not their fault. We got to make another one. We got to finish the story.
You know what?
Maybe. That might be what happened.
I'm thinking that if we decide to do Dune as an episode, I should probably read the book. If I get started now on the book.
We should send a message back in time to 2016. Be like, yeah. Vic, it's going to be a Dune movie. You got to start reading it now
in 2016.
It's like 500 pages long. You're going to read that in 2 months?
Oh, I'm real. Now I'm worried about one of the quadrants. Ridiculous. I'm worried about duration.
Instant correction. No second Alan Quartermain movie.
No. Okay. Alan Quartermain. Okay. Now, Sonny. Val.
No, I'm sorry. What? Instant correction of my correction. There were two of them. The first one was King Solomon's Mines, and the second one was Alan Quartermain, The Lost City of Gold, both starring Richard Chamberlain. JVL is right.
I've not seen either of these movies. I know nothing about them.
They were big in my house. They were very big in my house.
Did these come out in the 1930s?
No, 80s. These are 80s, mid-80s.
And he was also in Thornbirds.
The Thornbirds.
Yes, it's a complicated quadrant. But
was Rick Rossovich in these movies?
Hey, Rick Rossovich might have been in Thornbirds, actually.
Rick Rossovich was in Terminator, and I remember because I watched it and I felt so bad for him because he was being thrashed, thrown around.
He's like a big dude, and he's got to go up against Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's not fair. It was so terrible to see that. Okay, go.
Rick Rossovich, I'll get to Val in a second, but Rick Rossovich, it was funny. I was watching Streets of Fire the other night. It was on HBO Max.
That's an old one,
and he's in that too. He was in Top Gun, Streets of Fire, The Terminator, and God, there was something else.
Roxanne,
just like later. as Roxanne, just as like kind of the I don't know, not douchey exactly, just kind of like
no, he played it well. He played it well, douchey.
All right, Val. Val is a critically acclaimed documentary premiered at Cannes Film Festival about the life and times of Val Kilmer. The big draw of this documentary is that Val Kilmer was an early adopter of home video technology. His family, when he was growing up, had an 8mm camera. They shot home movies. You know, he was out making short films with his brothers, having fun. You know, we've got a lot of that footage. But he was also personally just like he was into VHS. So when he went to Juilliard, where he went to acting school, he brought his video camera.
Wasn't he the youngest?
The youngest actor ever accepted to the drama program at Juilliard. He had the camera on the set of Top Gun, Island of Dr. Moreau, other movies. But we'll talk about that a bit more in a second. But the point is, he has all of this footage. And, like, the directors, you know, are talking about how they have, like, literally, like, years of footage to watch. Just, like, boxes and boxes of stuff. To the point where, like, the movie Red Planet doesn't really get any discussion in this documentary at all. It's like kind of that late. It's that weird like 2000 era Val Kilmer where he was in a bunch of not that great stuff, but he was you know the star of it. And they said that there's like they had a whole long like 15 minute scene that was basically a short documentary that Kilmer himself shot about Mars and you know. Movies about Mars and that sort of thing. And they had to end up cut. They ended up having to cut it all because you know, it just didn't work with the story. So there is you know somewhere at some point we're gonna get like a 17 disc box set of the Val Kilmer home movies, and that will be what he survives on for the rest of his life. Because what he's surviving on right now is kind of depressing. The most depressing part of this movie is seeing Val Kilmer post throat cancer. He has a stoma in his throat. He can only talk by closing up the hole in his throat, and it sounds like a raspy squeak. He kind of hunches his neck forward to hide it. He's got a scarf on at all times. It's very depressing. But added to all of this, he's now basically doing the convention circuit. He's basically going town to town, signing photos from people. And the absolute most cringy moment is at the London Comic-Con festival. He's there signing photos, and it's just like a montage of people asking, I'll be your wingman anytime.
Sign it to Scotty and say, I'll be your wingman anytime, yeah. Iceman.
It's just like, horrible. you can see him cringing. And at one point, when he is at a screening of Tombstone in an old West town, it's like a kind of a kitschy thing, which would add, that actually sounds like kind of fun. I would totally go to that. But Tombstone at an old West town, he talks about how he gets real low. He gets real depressed when he thinks about, what his career now is just talking about things he's done in the past. And I think he understands that his career is over otherwise. He's not going to ever be an actor again. That just, he can't do it. He can't do it with the physical limitations that he has. And that's a shame, because Val Kilmer was a very good actor. He is shockingly funny, which a lot of leading men aren't. He's got great comic timing. He's a good looking leading guy. He's very good in all of these the movies that we watched and loved growing up. And it's kind of depressing, but it's also a very poignant movie, because you get a lot of footage of him with his family, with his mom in particular, who passes on while they're filming it,
yeah.
And has to go to her funeral, and is kind of going through her possessions and taking jewelry of hers and kind of claiming it for himself. But also, just like, there's this one moment that I love, and I'll stop after this, but there's this one moment that I really, really love, where he's watching his son, who narrates the documentary, sounds a lot like him, Jack Kilmer. He's watching his son play guitar, and the kid's playing guitar, and it sounds, it's a lot of distortion, he's not Slash, put it that way, but he's watching his kid play, and the camera cuts to a home video shot of him watching Jack as like a 4 or 5 year old playing like a Fisher Price guitar. Right. And it cuts back to Val Kilmer watching his grown son play, and you can see on film him going back to this memory in his head, to going back to this, watching his kid grow up, seeing what he has become. It is as JVL puts it earlier today, you can basically, we all have in our power now to see the passage of time. Just in a moment, we can pull up our phone and look at old images. We pull up images on the cloud. We pull up whatever, and we can see our kids at 1 or 2, and then at 10 or 12, 20, 30, whatever. And it made me realize, I wrote about this a little bit, but it basically made me realize that Val Kilmer is, like, in a weird way, almost a prophet. His past, his existence, the way he lived his life is how we will all live our lives for the rest of time going forward. We will all be these constant, we will all be constantly capturing photos and videos. We will all have it at our fingertips to kind of pull up at a moment's notice and look at it. And there's something, again, weirdly poignant about that. And I feel bad for Val Kilmer for that, the hand fate has dealt him, but I also think he is lucky in a very real way to have that sort of
record,
of his life and his family.
Thank you, Sonny. JVL, what do you think?
It's a tough watch. It's a really tough watch. It's a quad documentary. I thought it was quite good.
Like, just as as a documentary, it is, I mean, it begins with him saying, you know, I have had a magical life. And he has. I mean, he grew up living in on the Roy Rogers Ranch. His dad was a real estate developer, and they, when the Roy Rogers Ranch came up for sale, his dad bought it, and, you know, he was, he got a trip to the set of the Adam West Batman and got to sit in the Batmobile and stuff. And so it leans into all of that, and he believes it, but it's also not saccharine. I mean, there is nothing... nothing in this that is saccharine. It is, you know, all of his regrets are there. All of the pain with his own dad. There's a sequence where he's talking about his dad sort of, you know, was a rich real estate guy and then lost it all right as he, Val Kilmer, was starting to make some money.
Right.
And so his...
he had put it in shell companies, dummy.
Right. So his dad said, hey, you know, come and invest on, you know, what I'm doing. And his dad lost all of his money. And he said, you know, his choice was to either sue his father to get his money back or just have lost all of his money. Yeah. And he chose to lose all his money. And then, and so you think to yourself, boy, that would really embitter a guy. But then you get the video from his wedding where he's getting married and his dad is there. And he's like joking around with his pops.
Despite all that.
Despite all. And, but again, but not in a saccharine way. Like, it's not... you know, it's not like all's forgiven, but it's like this is life. We are bound together for these things. It is what it is. And, you know, the regrets with his marriage and divorce, which are all very raw and very real, the very raw and very real him understanding about his physical condition and what I thought was, a tough watch. And we talk about this and, you know, the lessons of this. And I think there's a way in which you can watch Val and see it as something beautiful. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be such a depressing thing. But as a documentary, I thought it was quite good. Mm-hmm. Victorino?
I actually thought it was... I thought it ran a little bit long, even though it was not. I mean, there are parts I think I would have shortened. And yet, despite that length... it's hard not to love the documentary. At least if you're a fan of Val Kilmer, you can relate because you'd seen him, you know, early on. I remember seeing him in Top Secret, not knowing who he was, I think, at the time, probably. And then Real Genius, of course. And then, of course, in Top Gun. And then you follow that actor along the rest of the way. It's hard to watch also because it's more than just, oh, I had this thing, I had a, you know, this operation and I can't talk right now. But it's more than just not being able to talk. Everything about him has changed physically, you know, and who knows what, how else psychologically, he's not the same. The stuff that he had, I mean, the fact that he has so much recorded is, I mean, it is a great, it's great for us. We get to see what, you know, that world was like. I love how it opens with just the guys hanging out in Top Gun. And what he says, which is so interesting, of course, is how, and this happens in movie sets where, you know, depending on who your characters, you know, associate with in the movie, they ended up forming different, you know, sides. So, and a lot of his camera footage, you don't see a lot of Tom Cruise at all, really. Or Anthony Edwards, yeah. or Tim Robbins, yeah. for that matter, because they would be on the other side, Merlin and Goose and Maverick. He was with it was Iceman and Slider and Wolfman
Wolfman in Hollywood
and Hollywood. Yeah. And he mentions that Barry Tubb, who plays Wolfman, he ended up for a while with Kelly McGillis. And it was just great to see all that. Also, by the way, while we're talking on the subject of Top Gun, the very brief, the all too brief scenes of the red carpet for the premiere of Top Gun, and Cruise looks so small. I know he's a short guy,
and young too. So young.
Yeah, so young. And here's the other interesting thing: if you look at that, if you're watching that red carpet scene where Tom Cruise comes out, and everybody's going crazy, of course. You could see his Mimi Rogers, who he was either dating or was married to at the time, and she was a much older woman. And it's always sucked, I think, for the dates of these stars on the red carpet, because when everybody asks, you know, for your photo, they don't want you they have to leave, and she looks totally uninterested.
Did you catch who Val Kilmer's date was to the red carpet for?
Yes, Cher.
Cher.
Crazy.
Who must have been 20 years older than he was.
Yeah. Crazy.
Right. I mean, this is clearly just a publicist arranged thing.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And people go wild. Because it was, it was Val Kilmer, it wasn't Tom Cruise, but it was still so fascinating. And then the clips of the part, like the dance party after, it just looked great. These guys were on top of the world. It was just absolutely fascinating.
Although that was also weirdly depressing. Because it's really? Just like the stars kind of
just
dancing.
Just doing their own thing. I don't know.
Just like, it looked like totally, it looked like weirdly staged and like, I don't know. I don't know. I saw that and I was like, oh boy, that's a lonely life.
I was absolutely fascinated. I wanted to see
I thought my favorite behind the scenes thing from this like early period is the play. Where Val Kilmer's doing a play at Juilliard, or just after Juilliard.
Oh, he's pushed back down
pushed down the cast list by first Kevin Bacon and then Sean Penn. And then he gets videotape footage of Kevin Bacon and Sean Penn. And Kevin Bacon looks, Kevin Bacon. But Sean Penn has, like, the same sneer that Sean Penn has had on his face every time I've ever seen him for the,
And this is just in the dressing room. My question to you guys is, do you think they thought he was weird for doing that? Were they sort of just like rolling their eyes when?
Yes. So I thought the other time I thought this was when he was talking to David Thewlis on the set of
Frankenheimer starts yelling at them.
There's that bit which is interesting. But if you just watch the bit where he's talking to David Thewlis, he's like, "Can I help you? How can I help you in this scene?" And like, he clearly just, like, wants the camera away from him. He just, like, I think he understands if Val Kilmer's a big star, he can't tell Val Kilmer to fuck off and get away from him. But he's, like, clearly very uncomfortable. Yeah. The whole thing is very uncomfortable. But, yeah, the stuff with Frankenheimer and
Hold on. Save that thought for later because that's its own thing. David Thewlis, he should have told him, one day I will turn into a wolf
Let's talk about this in three acts. And let's talk about it by decade. Let's talk about the 80s, then the 90s, the thousands, the aughts, because we're going to do a special episode about this anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about the 80s stuff and what struck you most. Because the thing that struck me most is that he's really an accidental film star, and he should have been on stage. Right. He clearly is pulled into movies because there's an opening for like hot young guys and that's where the money is. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem especially happy with it.
No. And in fact, it was a starring vehicle for Val Kilmer, Top Secret. Now we're talking about when he did Top Secret. And that was the Zucker Brothers. It was their, post Airplane. But my question is, don't they all want to be in theater? Don't they all want? Do Shakespeare, do Hamlet, or
no? Tom Cruise doesn't want to do Hamlet.
That's true.
Because this is the thing also, and this I think is the fundamental tragedy of Kilmer's acting career. There are actors and there are movie stars, and every once in a while you'll get a movie star who is also an actor, but not always. And Kilmer is 100% an actor and not a movie star. Mm-hmm. And worse than that, he is a character actor who happens to look like a leading man. Yeah. And, and so he's kind of like a little bit like Jude Law in that, right? I mean, Jude Law never wanted to be a leading man, but he was pushed into these lead roles because he was so damn handsome, right? Mm-hmm. You look at him. He's a movie star. He should be your leading man. And Kilmer never really got out of that, and so he's all of his best work is when he is in the background a little bit or playing second fiddle to somebody else. And he just never really got his arms around his career in the way that would have made it turn out better, I think.
Go ahead, Sonny, you were going to add something.
No, I mean, I think that's totally right. I mean, if you look at his work in the 1990s, his two best movies that he is in are probably Heat and Tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not The Saint, where he actually gets to do more acting, where he gets to like be a bunch of different characters. Right. And he talks about this in the movie a little bit, that like, you know, I gave up doing, I didn't want to do another Batman because I wanted to do The Saint, because I actually got to do stuff. I wasn't just stuck in a suit and, you know, smiling or grimacing. You know, he was like, he could actually act.
What I loved, by the way, where, and this is sort of end of the 80s, early 90s, and he only, he teases us with just two of these, because I'm sure he's done them for a lot, his audition tapes. The first one for Full Metal Jacket, and then the second one for Goodfellas. I felt like in the documentary, watching his progression, that that's where he takes a turn for the weird-er, but that's kind of what a lot of actors do, right? They do, they send these, at least that's what they used to do, right? Send these tapes or...
Well, before you're a star, certainly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people actually did that with Full Metal Jacket, because you know, people heard like, oh, Stanley Kubrick's making a Vietnam War movie. I'm going to send a tape to him in England, and that'll get me on board. The Henry Hill one was interesting because he sounds very much like Hill, or at least Hill as in the popular imagination. But yeah, I think he got lucky and kind of stumbled into The Doors, in part because he, you know, looks a lot like Jim Morrison.
I was wondering why he did not get any part in Full Metal Jacket. Because Full Metal Jacket is a movie with, in the same way Saving Private Ryan was, or Thin Red Line, there's like 35 parts for guys his age, right?
Yes.
And you could give him a part with three lines and he would have gone over there and done it for scale because it's working for Stanley Kubrick.
Right.
And I think the answer is that his look was wrong. He doesn't look like a GI from 1970. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just, everything about his face is too pretty.
Too good looking, because it would be, it's like, you know what I thought was ridiculous? Was at the end of Thin Red Line, and the cameo by George Clooney.
Yeah, George Clooney.
In a World War II movie, it just didn't work for me. Let alone John Travolta, but you know.
I am surprised that, like, you know, he never got a look for Goodfellas or stuff like that. But it's charming, because the other thing is, he was a name brand already. When he was sending out these auditions, there's something charmingly self-effacing and not entitled about it. Like, that he was just, like, sitting around. And it's a little weird. Right. It's a little thirsty. But, again, because he wanted to be a working actor. This is a guy who has a very British approach to acting. You know, it's just would like to be up on stage 50 weeks a year, you know, doing
wanted to work with Scorsese. He wanted to work
with him. Yeah. Did he want to work with Joel Schumacher? Is that who did Batman for? Boy,
we wanted to be Batman.
So imagine,
everyone wants to be Batman.
So imagine this. So he says that the day, so he raps Batman, and the next day is on set for Heat with Michael Mann.
Can you
imagine going from a Joel Schumacher production to a Michael Mann production the next morning? What a weird
remember what
culture
he said?
Shift.
Remember how he described it in the documentary? He said it was like being in an indie film.
Yeah. Oh, it's very funny when he's saying that too, because they're showing like the behind the scenes footage. There's like 300 people there. Yeah. It's the shootout.
Yeah.
It's like the Los Angeles shootout scene. It's you know. God.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. So that's his 80s, and then he transitions into the 90s stuff. And that's where his career just like doesn't achieve liftoff. You know, it's The Saint is his chance to be like a real star. And he just doesn't settle. He just doesn't settle back into the kind of roles. Right. Where he is weak as an actor was in the management of his career, I think, in picking parts and looking for to slot himself into work the right way.
Because he picks some really great parts.
Yes.
I mean, like, it's hard to imagine anybody else as Doc Holliday in that role. And we say that despite the fact that there was another, you know, movie with Doc Holliday in it that came right out right
the one
around
with
that
Kevin Costner
time.
That one
the one with Kevin Costner you know the, he it's hard to imagine anybody else as Chris from Heat, right? Like he
yeah,
he has that kind of haunted you know dead-eyed look to him that is I mean he's the best thing in a movie with that features Al Pacino and Robert De Niro going head to head with each other. And like
there was a little clip of Tom Sizemore in it too. Love that. Yeah. Fantastic. Love to see that. And then we get to the island of Dr. Moreau. Now, had you we all knew about the problems on that set and that it was a nightmare. But as you were just saying, JVL and Sonny, about his act, he wanted to work with Stanley Kubrick, for example. And likewise, he wanted an opportunity to be with the great Marlon Brando. But of course,
everybody who has ever wanted that has been disappointed by what they got.
Well, I think we were kind of shocked about what we saw.
It's amazing.
No, we're not. Let's talk about what we saw because
I assume that not everybody who's going to listen to this will actually sit down and watch it.
Should because it's really you can't believe what you're seeing. It's not a fat suit. JVL, go ahead.
It's not a fat suit. There is a moment where he is on set and they are looking at Brando as Brando is being wheeled on set in a you know a giant caftan and being carried, and he says, "That's not Marlon, is it?" And whoever he's staying with goes, "I don't think so." And he calls up to this guy, hey, what's your name? And he says, "Norm." And Kilmer says, deadpan, "Today, the role of Marlon Brando will be played by Norm." And it is, I almost fell off the sofa. Yeah. It was so funny.
It was so amazing.
But so what happens, I forget who the original director was, but the original director walks off the picture. John Frankenheimer, himself a legendary director, is brought in to salvage it. He wants no part of Brando. He and Kilmer don't like each other. The whole picture is just, at that point, basically beyond salvage. It's so far behind its shooting schedule that it is heading into legendary flop land. And Kilmer is just caught. This is one of those movies where, you know, people walk around joking, who do I have to fuck to get off of this picture?
Right.
And maybe the funniest thing in the whole documentary, even funnier than the part of Marlon Brando will be played by Norm, is him walking around this, I don't know if it's a set or what,
like a hut,
looking for Marlon and finding him. And fat Marlon is on a hammock. And he wants to talk. Val Kilmer wants to talk with him. And Marlon's just like,
"Yeah, give us a push."
And no, it twice.
Push, give us a push, boy.
Push it harder.
Right,
and Marlon just wants somebody to push him so that the hammock will rock. This is, and Val Kilmer must have been thinking to himself, "I cannot fucking believe this. I have just lit my career on fire because I wanted the chance to hang out with Marlon Brando. And all Brando wants is, first of all, he has somebody else pretending to be him on set. But then when I go to talk to him, because I would like to learn about acting from him, he's like, push the hammock."
But I like, the stories about this movie are legend. And, you know, it's for you, you get a sense of why in the, like, 5 minutes of footage that we see. But everybody who worked with Marlon Brando after 1960,
after Streetcar
or so, basically after Streetcar, you know, I mean, like going all the way back to whenever that 51 or whenever Streetcar Named Desire came out, like I don't know what he was expecting. I don't know I remember a story about Superman, the motion picture, right, where he basically says to the director, he says to Richard Donner, Nobody knows what Superman's dad looks like. What if we just had like a chicken? I'll do the voice. We just have like a chicken up there, and I'll do Kal-El's voice, and then I'll say the lines. But I don't want to. That way, I don't have to be on camera. And Richard Donner's like, "No, you can't do that, Marlon. You have to actually be in the movie for the 10 minutes that you're in this movie, if that, for your $1 million payday." He's like, "Oh, fine."
Yeah.
But I mean, it was like that the whole rest of his career was just a series of struggles, and, you know.
Yeah. That's right. When you were talking about the Comic-Con, that is, for me, I think in the documentary, the maybe the low point. And it's when he's not feeling well. and maybe because he's still going through his treatments. And he's in that they wheel him out, and he has to put the blanket over his head. So yeah. People are staring like, who is being pushed in this wheelchair with a blanket? And he's sick and he's not well. And then he has to go back. And then, as he said, the line forms again with everybody wanting him to sign, "Will you be my wingman?" or whatever. It's
come up with something better than
it's a lot.
This is the thing I beg of anybody who's listening right now. If you ever go to a convention and you are getting something signed, please pick something that is not the most famous thing that that person has done to get them to sign. Like, it could have been Kiss Kiss Bang Bang or Spartan or, even if go back to, like, Real Genius or something. But, like, not Top Gun. Frankly, not even Heat or Tombstone. Like, something else.
So here is the way I think you can watch this and not be depressed. Because it is quite depressing. I think we can all agree.
Yeah, the Comic-Con thing was like The Wrestler.
It is frequently depressing. Yeah. It is frequently depressing.
So Kilmer is an actor, and he is a real artist, I think. I mean, you know, he has all of that creative soul disposition stuff that is affectation in a lot of people who are not serious actors is real for him. And what happened to him is like a great painter going blind. The thing that you do is simply taken away from you. And you can still live in the world. You're around the world, but you are held at a total remove from what it was that was your everything, your essence. Right. And the fact that even his face has changed as a result of the drugs makes you think that he's almost like locked in, like that he's not there anymore. You know, that Val That's Kilmer right. is gone and this golem is here instead. But there are moments when the film really shows how wrong that is. And it's all about body motion. You see him sort of playfully walking through, I think it's the Juilliard building. And he's like stealing along the wall and doing a little dance. And those are all those are his movements.
That's
you
right.
recognize That's that. Right. And they those are moments when you realize, no, he's in there. Mm-hmm. That guy is still in there. He doesn't look like him. He can't talk like him, but he can't do the work anymore. But he is there. And what this movie is it is the act of him being able to create again. Yeah. And it's very different because it's a documentary and because his son, who very uncannily sounds like him and has an incredibly
similar voice. I
thought
it was him.
Voice.
I was so confused how he was able to talk until he realized it was his son.
But this movie is him being able to create again. And in a way that had he been also a writer, he might have been able to, you know, he would have kept going, right? It would have been fine. Sure. Had he been a producer or a director, it would have been fine. He could have kept going. But he was just an actor. He was a pure actor and he couldn't do it anymore.
Voice.
But this movie lets him express the need of his soul again. And that makes it kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Good movie.
Thank you, JVL. Well put. And that's a good way I think we can end this until we get to our special episode coming up for subscribers.
Yeah. We're going to do a draft, Val Kilmer draft. It's going to be very exciting.
You don't want to miss it. You don't want to miss it. Corrections, shout outs, anything? Everything okay? Everything good? Good.
No.
That is all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, compliments, tweet us at Sunny Bunch at Victorina Mattis. Again, be sure to subscribe to us on Patreon. Just go to subbeacon.com. We are there. Tell your friends. Until next time. Okay, so finally, this whole thing about Vic's restaurant, not to be confused with, there was a famous one in New York, I think it was Vic's
Trader
Cafe,
Vic's.
And it was Trader Vic's, and then of course there was like a Victor's Cafe, but that was Cuban in New York. This was a place called, Vic's Oven, and listener and friend Tanya McKenna put it up there on Twitter and asked, what's on the menu? Which is lovely and funny until you see the picture on the window is a giant octopus with tentacles splayed out. Now, why would anyone think that I would want a restaurant.
My octopus teacher.
But yes, for a restaurant. I mean, come on. It's Vic, and there's an octopus with tentacles, and I just want to add one other point because I looked it up. Where is Vic's oven? And it's located in Beaver, PA.
No, I'm sure it's fine.